The entire principle of the new year is that it's an opportunity to start over. You know, the calendar runs out, we hit December 31st, we're back at January 1st again. And it just goes around and around like that with a slight nuance of difference every time. And we take the moment, the new year changing in our calendar corresponds to the shifting from dark back into light, the preponderance of light, so it's a very symbolic opportunity. I mean, some of these marks in the sand are just purely writing on water, but some of them have a reality. The solstice or the equinox or whatever, which one it is, it's the winter solstice, right? When dark is in the ascendant and then it turns to light, is a really a much more powerful image than just arbitrarily January 1st. But at the same time, these traditions gain power, and they have an inherent, perhaps, astronomical or astrological power, but they also have a power that we give them. But that's not insignificant, because God knows we need all the help we can get. So when we're shifting over into a new time, we really owe it to ourselves to take advantage of that. It's a naive person who thinks he doesn't need external help. Now, what we also have to understand is, what is it to change? This is, we feel like we're a fixed entity. We're always in the same essential physical body. But that physical body is constantly shifting around. It's constantly becoming older, primarily. It's constantly sort of moving from its birth to its expiration date. You know, best if used by, right there. And really hopeless after a certain period of time, right? So we're always just sort of moving toward that. Every 7 years, they say the cells are completely different. And there's nothing actually fixed about this, except there is a repeating pattern that we can always recognize. For many years of my early spiritual life, I lived in the monastic area of Ananda Village, little cluster of nuns. We lived there about 8 or 9 years together. And we used to meditate every morning in this teepee, this really decrepit canvas teepee with this inner plastic lining, and you had to actually literally bend over and almost crawl into it. Very, very primitive, absolutely fabulous. Just loved it. But the same group of women would meditate together every morning, and then we'd all go back to our own, we didn't meditate that long, and then we'd go back to our own individual trailers or cottages where we lived, and we'd meditate on our own too. But I used to puzzle, and the strangest thoughts sometimes would occur to me, that how, when we would go in there and seemingly merge our consciousness so completely, how come we each went home in the right body with the right ego? How come we didn't just kind of switch around? I mean, this was before all those movies of people switching around were so active, but I used to really puzzle, how come we always come back to the right one, or the wrong one, but the same one in any case? We just always do. There's this, I mean, I can explain it philosophically, and I will for a tiny bit right now, but we are trapped in these patterns of energy. A free soul like Master, free soul like Ananda Muhima, like Sri Ramakrishna, they literally can live in any body that they want to tune into. Master said to one of his disciples, remember, you have a sour taste in your mouth. Lahiri Mahashaya cried out that he was drowning. He felt himself drowning. And it turned out a boat went down, I believe in Japan, sort of at the very moment that that happened. A cook with the temper in the ashram where Sri Ramakrishna lived became angry at a cat who broke into his kitchen, and he beat the cat with a stick. And then he went in to see his guru, Ramakrishna, and Ramakrishna had welts on his back. And the cook with his temper said, who did this to you, Master? And the Master said, you did. When you beat that cat, you were beating me. Just a cat that is identified with everything. It's extraordinary to meditate on that. What would it be like to be equally present in all of creation? instead of so strictly defined by this little one that we live in. I was leading a retreat at Ananda Village one year, and the subject was the chakras, and we were talking about earth, air, sky, fire, water. And it was the summer, and we took a field trip down to the Yuba River. And we were stretched out on granite rocks, so we were feeling the earth element. And we were next to the rushing river, and we were feeling the water element. And we were looking up at the sky, and I saw up there a hawk circling like this. And just because we'd been concentrating so much, for just, you know, the barest instant, there was this feeling almost of transference of my identity into that hawk. And it was such a moment. What would it be like if in the reality of creation, this was an arbitrary point instead of the one that always defines our perception, our experience? Now, the masters talk to us about their freedom. Swami Kriyananda used the phrase once, "I don't identify with Swami Kriyananda. I consider him only an event for which I am responsible." And I remember one occasion when something that he'd very publicly put forward completely disintegrated. And he just sat very calmly and he said, "I could be very embarrassed if I chose to be so, but I choose not to be." What is there to be embarrassed about? Well, the event, which is called Swami Kriyananda, did not work out in exactly the way that he had hoped. And everyone looked at his body and thought, well, this is Swami Kriyananda. But from inside his body, why should he accept that? Why should he accept that this was his self-definition? Something had happened, clearly, and he had some responsibility for it. But taking responsibility and defining our reality by that are very, very different things. Sri Yukteswar made it clear that we have to take responsibility. His training of master was defined by those simple words, learn to behave. He did not accept, as Yogananda said, somewhere along the way, master described himself, probably not entirely accurately, but he had picked up the idea that being spiritual allowed him to be irresponsible on the material plane. And Sri Yukteswar, as Yogananda said, seemed perfectly satisfied with his spiritual development, but not at all with the way he related to the rest of life. You are responsible. Learn to behave. So we must understand this in the right way. But you see, what's going on with us is merely that we have our radios tuned to a certain station. And as long as we remain tuned to that station, those are the radio waves that we receive. Those are the vibrations that pass through us, and that because they pass through so consistently, we think that this is who I am. But what we have to understand is there is absolutely nothing fixed about that, even not about our physical bodies, which transform constantly right before our eyes. They remain consistent to the extent that we are responsible and we have to carry that out. But the inner reality is completely and only a pattern of energy. Just a pattern of energy. And a decision on our part as to what we're going to tune into. Over Christmas dinner, a woman sharing our table was talking about how odd Priyabans are sometimes in terms of the way their physical bodies manifest. And this is what I mean. I understood exactly what she meant. Many years ago, when I was still living at Ananda Village, I was involved in political things that put me into close association with many of the people who lived around us who were not, at that time, meditators. Many of them were hard-drinking, hard-living, hard-smoking kind of folks. And they lived a lot in their senses. Not everyone, but many they lived in their senses. They drank, they had a sensual life, they identified as men, they identified as women. And they were, just seemed so much older than me. And I don't mean older like more mature. I just mean more worn out than me, even though we were often the same age. But what I realized was they were very identified. They vibrated with the movement of that body. When it was 54, when it was 60, when it was 37, they were just right in that reality. And Ananda people, people who meditate, people who believe or even understand another vibration, we're completely mutable. You know, there is this encasing that we have to live with and have to be responsible for and have to take care of, but increasingly, we don't let it define us. We just go through it. We just go through it because it's the vehicle that we're sort of been assigned. It's the job we've got, is to be ourselves, but we just go through it. It's fascinating when you watch an Ananda choir because you can tell, because some of them have white hair and wrinkles, and some of them have natural color hair and don't have wrinkles, and some of them have pudged out as we do or lost our hair, all those different things. But as soon as they start singing, it's really hard to tell how old people are. You can force yourself to know by analyzing the data, but you can't really tell because they've all hit a vibration. And the vibration is the same if they're singing together, but the vibration also, by its very definition, has no age because it's moving into eternity. It's moving from time into eternity. It's lifting itself up above this ordinary material world and identifying with that which is changeless. Now, the real change that we're all looking for as we go from 2013 to 2014, which is really pretty arbitrary. I mean, yes, we're measuring it all from the time that Jesus lived, which, I mean, that's not a bad time. The Hebrews measure from something else. The Arabics measure from something else. But everybody's measuring from some point in time when they think it mattered. But we are transitioning because we're always transitioning because nothing ever sits there until it's dead and as long as we're alive. And even when it's dead, it then begins to disintegrate and turn into something else. But what we're really trying to transition from is not from one period of time to another period of time, but from time itself into timelessness. When Swami Kriyananda was in the last years of his life, his poor body was so just pathetic. He himself, you know, he loved to use words like decrepit and things like that, and he would joke about it, just how impossible it was becoming. And it would go to a near-death state every so often. And he would, you know, he couldn't get out of a chair. He needed help. Sometimes it would take two people to move him about. It just wasn't working like bodies are supposed to work. But as soon as he got it settled somewhere, his face would just separate itself completely, even though you could still see the wrinkles. If you analyzed it, you could tell. But the force that was coming through it had moved out of time into timelessness. Right after he died, soon after he died, when I watched the Finding Happiness movie, and right at the beginning, there's a little bit of biography of Swamiji, talks about his childhood in Romania, and there's his father took a home movie, and there Swamiji is on a little bicycle, and he runs right into the camera like children do, like this. And he was about six, and the face that comes right into that camera is exactly the face he had when he died. And I've looked at that many times and thought, but this is the face of a recognizably seven-year-old child, and he was recognizably nearly 87 when he died. But he had moved out of time into timelessness. And that is a vibration. That's all that it is. We vibrate on the level of matter, or we vibrate on the level of spirit. When we vibrate on the level of spirit, when we become a receiving station for that vibration, then this still exists and it sort of does its thing. But it no longer has that much to do with us. It lives, it dies, it takes new incarnations. Here we are again. You know, just over and over. I try to imagine living in another body, not because I I'm determined to reincarnate, but I have a slight suspicion that I will. Seems probable, let's just put it like that. But I'm determined to be so indifferent to that reality. Just indifferent to it. Taking care of business, but just indifferent to it. So let's be 2, let's be 7, let's be 30, let's be 45, let's be 90. You know, it's just the costume. Let the vibration be completely out of time. Now, on our New Year's celebration several years ago, we had this thought, which we've been repeating since, because it seems ideal for this transition. And that is to bring into our New Year's experience the idea of mantra. Because sound is one of the most powerful expressions of vibration that we know. You know, sound itself can actually be measured as vibration when you're tuning a piano. And mantra are those words of ancient languages that have unique power, ancient combinations of sounds that have unique power. And every Sunday in our fire ceremony on Sunday mornings, we do a little bit of 2 very classic mantras, the Gayatri Mantra, the Mahamrityunjaya Mantra. These are mantras that have been recited in India for literally thousands of years. No one knows how long. And these words have inherent power because every sound carries with it a vibration, and every vibration is a level of consciousness. That's what makes Swami's music so unusual. That's what makes Master's chant so unusual, is that Master talks about the chants that he spiritualized them. Well, he was able to spiritualize them because they came from a consciousness where he was translating into sound literally a level of reality. I heard Swamiji speak once, actually, in this temple. And for some reason, that particular night, I was conscious of something that I had always known to be true, but I really felt it to be true that night, which is that what Swamiji was giving us first was his vibration. And then just so we would be able to relate to it, he pasted words on it. And those words were coherent, and the ideas were interesting, but I was really aware of the fact that the vibration came first, and then he pasted words on it so we could recognize it. That taught me when I began to listen to him after that. Whenever I would hear him speak, I tried as hard as I could to be absolutely in the present and to hear him talk one word at a time. You know, not run ahead, not go back, but just to sit right in the vibration that he was putting forth. When I made an audio book out of the book I wrote about Swamiji, Swami Kriyananda, as we have known him, it was a fascinating experience because I wanted the recording of that book to have the power of Swami's consciousness, which is what the stories were about. So I had to do my best to be loyal to that. And I remembered what I was just describing. And so I tried to imbue every word with the vibration that was inherent in that word to convey both the meaning and the higher power behind it. And I watched my mind. This is how it came down. When one reads, normally, you're always that little bit ahead. And I had to look at one word at a time and have absolute faith that the next word would be there. And it was a very interesting exercise. I'd written the words, and because I'd edited it so many times, I could sometimes even recite them. But I had to block out of my mind the next word and not become anxious about whether it would be there. And you see, that's why it's so hard for us to live in the now. We know there's going to be another moment, but we always want to ensure that it's going to be there. So instead of settling right into this reality, we always divide ourselves a little bit into that because we don't really have faith. And we don't really believe that anybody's even going to take care of us in the next moment. And that's what keeps our vibration what it is. Identified with this, worried about the past, worried, thinking about the future, anxious about what's happening now, worried about this. That's the radio station we listen to. How is that working for us? And could it be better? So we're going to do now a few ceremonies of sound, repeating the mantras that many of you are familiar with, and if not, will they appear on the board? Or you'll hear them repeated. Swamiji is going to lead us via recording, and put your own voice into it if you can. And practice exactly what I was saying. Try as much as possible together, all of us, to believe completely that all I have to concentrate on is this exact moment. And if I am in this moment completely with what is given to me and enter it into it with my whole heart, that every moment after it will take care of itself. And nothing more is asked of me, not only tonight, but ever. So we'll chant the mantra, first one mantra, then we'll hear the gong. And listening again to the sound of the gong, Master had the tradition of playing the gong on New Year's Eve. So we're following in his footsteps by listening to the gong. We'll have a few moments of silence. We'll repeat the pattern with the next mantra. And at the same time, also, we'll create the vibration of light. Many of you remember amazing experiences with light. We were laughing because one year we put the candles really close together and we had a fire magnificent to remember, but never again. So tonight we'll just light a few candles, but also allowing ourselves to see the fire. After we do the sound mantras, then we'll go into our purification ceremony. When we come to that, we'll talk more about the power of light and the power of fire. But right now, let's do it with just sound.